Welcome to our paranormal afterlife. This is our paranormal afterlife, and I'm your host, Simon Bowne. And you can enjoy the extended version of this episode ad-free, along with over 100 hours of extended episodes on Patreon. This week, I'm talking to Jan Canty about her book, Rekindled: Healing Grief Through the Science and Experience of After-Death Communication. Jan is a psychologist, writer, photographer, educator, consultant, and cancer survivor. She holds a terminal degree in psychology, as well as a postdoctoral fellowship from the Wayne State University School of Medicine. Hi, Jan. Thanks a lot for coming on the podcast.
Thank you for having me, Simon. I do appreciate it.
So we're going to talk about your book. It's called Rekindled: Healing Grief Through the Science and Experience of After-Death Communication. But before we get into that, I just wanted to ask you about your podcast. It's Domino Effect of Murder. So can you tell us about that?
I was trying to fill a gap in podcasts by having that show. It is a forum primarily for people who have suffered a loss of somebody close to them. It need not be a relative, but somebody close to them because of homicide. And I wanted to give them a forum to speak about their experiences because it's kind of an absence. It doesn't fall into true crime. This does not focus on the perpetrator. And there's a lot that needs to be said and a lot that's unknown about them. So by talking to people who've directly been impacted, I felt that that was an important niche to fill.
Did you find there was a lot more people out there with this than you expected?
I found that people were generous in their disclosures, that person A would tell person B, and then they would come to me and ask to be on the show. It was kind of like a network that I tapped into. They were a little hesitant at first, but when the word spread that I was not there to exploit them, I was there to support them, then they came forward, and it was very gratifying because they were trusting me with very vulnerable memories and information. And I always felt honored that they did that. And I hope that in the process that it helped other people. It was pretty well received. I had the show for 6 years and it was heard in 24 countries.
That didn't focus on after-death communication, but it just kind of came up, didn't it, in conversation?
Again and again. Exactly. I didn't search for it. I didn't even ask about it. This was information that was volunteered by guests. And the first time I thought, oh, that's interesting. And the second time I thought, yeah, that reminds me of the other guest. And the third person that volunteered it, I thought, huh, this is kind of a pattern. And by the fourth person, I thought, I got to look into this. And I just took a deep dive and read everything I could get my hands on, which is partly what led me to your show. And I started speaking to others who've done research in this field. And it was like opening up a treasure trove of information. And then when I started actually asking guests if they've ever had an ADC, almost everybody said yes. It was startling to me. I did not expect that at all.
And were you quite a materialist before this?
Very much so. Oh, yes. It was drummed into me, not only by my culture, but my training as a psychologist. You know, we're supposed to be focused on statistics and charts and bar graphs. And if you can't show it in numbers, it doesn't exist, and that kind of a thinking format. So initially, it was like I pushed it away. I didn't have a framework for understanding it. And that's a shortcoming of my training, looking back. So definitely, it was late in life when I finally started opening up to the idea that this was a human experience. And it got to the point where I would now say that it's really something that should be included in the training of anybody who works in the field of grief. It's essential.
Can you tell us, why is it that you decided to do that podcast about that subject?
Well, not only was it a gap that existed out there in the world, I could not find other shows like it, but back in 1985, my husband was murdered. And this was before the internet, before cell phones, before grief therapy, actually. And there was just no help out there, no directions or information, nobody to turn to, no groups to seek assistance from. And I made do with what I had and made a lot of important decisions along the way, which turned out, fortunately, to be helpful. So it never left me. It was always in the back of my mind that someday I would be ready to take my training as a psychologist and braid it with my personal experience of being a what we call homicide survivor in the States and weave them together to be able to be of assistance to others that are in the same predicament. Because there's such a need and there's so little resources. And that's not just in the United States. It's global. It's not a pleasant topic. And politicians don't want to deal with it. Physicians don't want to deal with it. Lawmakers get pulled into it when they're expected to. But it's kind of an oversight. And it's unfortunate because it impacts a lot of people. Matter of fact, there's a statistic that says that for every homicide that occurs, 7 to 10 people are deeply and immediately impacted. So you take any statistic, let's say 20,000 murders in the United States per year on average, and for each of those, there's 10 people that are immediately impacted. And so it has a huge ripple effect. And so I just thought, I'm not going to let my own personal tragedy go to waste. I want to use it for fuel to help other people because I know what I'm talking about. I've traveled this path. It's not theory. It's nothing I learned from studying books. And it was always in the back of my mind, but it took me decades to get to that point.
And you had some kind of after-death communication, didn't you, the night that happened?
I did indeed. I did not have a name for it then. I just had it. What happened was my husband was supposed to be home by 7 o'clock. He had called and told me that. And by 7 o'clock, we had a terrible hailstorm. It was July, and it was unusual that we didn't have that violent weather typically in Detroit, but we did that night. And I know the roads were bad, so I wasn't immediately concerned when he didn't show. But 8 o'clock came and 9, 10. By 11 o'clock, I started getting concerned. And, you know, again, this is back before cell phones, so there was no way to reach him. And I started pacing. I was really worried. I went into his home office in our house. It was an older house. And I went into the bathroom that was part of the office that he had. And I looked in the mirror and I said out loud, "He's dead. He's not coming home." And it startled me because it was like my voice, but it was not my thought. It felt like it's hard to put into words, but it felt like it came through me, but it not originated with me. And when I said that out loud, I immediately shut it down. It's like, what was that? And I didn't tell a soul about that experience for 30 years. I had no framework for making sense out of it. So I just pushed it away and thought just it was stress and that I didn't process it much more than that. But it never left me. It was always a curiosity way in the back of my mind.
Did you find out about him things that you didn't know?
Oh, yeah. Not immediately. But in increments, 10 days after his disappearance, I was called down to police headquarters to meet with Inspector Gail Hill of the Detroit Homicide Division. And just knowing that I was being summoned there told me it was not going to be a good interview in terms of the outcome. So I went down there and he started telling me things about my husband that I believed him because of his position, but it made no sense. It's like he doesn't know my husband. He can't, this isn't right. He started telling me that he'd been handing out cash in the red light district of Detroit, hanging out there. He'd been making friends with some really street people that were criminals, basically. And he suggested I go home and check my finances. And he said that, I'll never forget this part. He said to me, he was very short in his words. He said to me, I don't have a body yet, but I'm pretty sure he's been murdered and we'll be in touch. And with that, I left and went home and looked into my banking. And what should have been comfortable, I found out we were approximately $30,000 in debt. I was stunned. Everywhere I looked, and this is 1985 dollars, which is more like $75,000 today. And he hadn't paid taxes. We were behind on mortgage, car payments, savings was emptied out. I even went up into our attic where he had a silver dollar collection that was given to him by his father. And that was gone. The papers were there, the box was there, but the contents were missing. So even that had been liquidated. So it was my first huge wake-up call that he was a mystery. He was not the person I thought he was. And that only intensified as events unfolded. I really didn't know the full story until about 2 years later, when a reporter came to me and told me he wanted to write a book about this. And I was very reluctant to do so. And that's another story, but we ended up doing it. And he started telling me what he had discovered and showed me evidence. And I found out that he basically led two lives, that he was never faithful, that he never did drugs, but he supported people who did. And he put my own life in jeopardy because one of the things that he had done was I had prepared a kind of an album of photographs listing the contents of our house in case we ever had a fire or some other emergency so I could produce it for our insurance company to show you, to show them what we had and the approximate value. And that was missing. And I found out that he had circulated that in the red light district. So people not only had our address, they had the layout of our house, the contents of our house, photographs of the interior, and approximate value of the contents. We'd also started having, as I reflected back, I remembered we had had hang-up calls at night. And at first, I just thought that's all it was. Somebody didn't know what they were doing and called our number by mistake. But gradually, things began to pull into place. Another memory I had was being followed home one night. And it was somebody that came up on my bumper and then would back off. And I just started pushing it all together. And I'm like, not only did he endanger his own life, but he led them to our front door. And I was really terrified when I realized that. The only part that helped was that they'd been arrested eventually.
And I suppose being a survivor of homicide, that can often get into the media. And that's not going to help with your grief, is it? That intrusion.
You got that right, Simon. Yeah. Anything salacious, anything that involves something unusual is going to make it to the news. And this was a pretty sordid tale. So the media was so relentless that they camped out at my front door, they showed up at my office, and they even disrupted his funeral. I had gone to the funeral 90 minutes early specifically to tell the staff that I did not want the media in there. And they kind of brushed it off and said, well, it's a public sidewalk. We can't stop them. And I go, no, but you can stop them from being in the building, because it's your building. And they didn't even make an attempt to do that. So the media showed up. And this is, again, I'm dating myself now, but they had those big video cameras that they use on their shoulders. It was very intrusive, very public. And to the point where an argument broke out at the funeral between one of my husband's friends and one of the reporters, and it escalated. It was awful. And I ended up leaving before it was even concluded. And in time, when it would not die down, even 18 months later, it kept being in the news. I finally left Detroit altogether and never went back.
How did your journey with after-death communication begin? What were the first things that you were finding?
As I told you, I had that one experience back in when he was murdered. Well, that was kind of set aside and I walled it off. But in my podcast, I had these people that kept bringing it up. And after a while, I thought, I owe it to them to understand this better. So I read what I could. I listened to podcasts. I started asking about it. And in time, I thought, here's another area where homicide survivors are overlooked and general people in grief. And this needs to be discussed from the best I could do it, from a vantage point of experience and also from what we knew from research. My priorities was to support grief-stricken individuals more than trying to prove anything scientifically. But I felt like I needed to at least tip my hat to that and talk a little bit about what we did know and connect with others who are doing the same. Because as a psychologist, you have to stay abreast of what's new in the field. And this is new in the field. We're studying consciousness today. And so it's been a real journey, and I feel more grounded because of it. But I will tell you that when I wrote Rekindled, it was like a coming out. It was like a public declaration that I'm no longer a reductionist, and here's why. You can take it or you can leave it, but this is my thinking, and this is the reason behind it, in the hope that people who've had after-death communications will feel validated, supported, and reassured, and for people doing grief work to get them at least curious enough to look into the literature that's out there, which is quite a bit, so that they can be supportive and be understanding, but not dismissive, and worse yet, to pathologize it, because that's the last thing somebody in grief needs.
Could you give us an example of one of the stories from your podcast that they told you?
There are so many. Let's see. Well, one of the earlier ones was a young woman by the name of Shelley Edwards Jorgensen. And she wrote a book called Beautiful Ashes, eventually, years later. She was 16 when her father murdered her mother and burned down the house, which is where the name of the book comes from. And he had threatened to do so ever since she could remember. There was a lot of domestic violence. And he kept threatening it and threatening it. One day, he made good on the threat. Well, she was home from school for about a week to deal with the funeral and all that was entailed. But eventually, it was at Christmas time, she had to go back to school at some point. She was an avid basketball player, and it was her first or second day back at school, high school, and she was on the court dribbling a ball, and she was one of the better athletes and had an easy shot to make the basket, and she was about ready to do that when she looked up, and she saw her mother in the stands, is in the audience looking at the basketball game, and she was stunned. And she heard her mother more telepathically say to her, I love you, and everything will be all right. Well, she fumbled the ball. Her coach got on her. She didn't know what to make of it. And it was a break was called, and they went into the locker room for a few minutes. And she was sitting there shaking, thinking, am I cracking up? And it happened the second time in the locker room where she heard her mother more telepathically than auditorily say, I love you and everything will be all right. It happened a third time 2 weeks later when she was shopping at the mall for a Christmas gift. and she went by her mother's favorite shoe store. And what caught her eye was that nobody was in the store. No customers, no clerks, but all the lights were on. And she went in the store, and she never did see anybody. There was just music playing. And she heard the same words a third time. So she started keeping track of it. And it later she disclosed that it was so important because she was thinking of taking her own life when she got that third message. So it saved her life. And it got to the point where she just started jotting down these key moments in her life, which ended up being the backbone to her book. And as a teenager, she had every reason to dismiss that and hide it. She did not tell a soul, just like I didn't. Most of people with ADCs and grief do not. And it was very genuine and also pivotal. People who have ADC experiences, after-death communication experiences, often describe them as pivotal. They are often reassuring in a very big way and help them reconnect. So they're extremely meaningful. They stick with them. They do not dismiss them. They're not perceived as a memory or a daydream. It's very vivid. And they find that that helps more than anything to address their grief, which is another reason why grief clinicians ought not dismiss them, because they are so helpful most of the time.
And is it a thing at the moment where most grief clinicians, they won't even go there? They don't want to know about this stuff.
Yes and no. If we're talking about grief experts in hospice, they do an outstanding job. They are very receptive, very knowledgeable, to the point where they now often include this information in their packets of pamphlets that they hand out to families who come into hospice. Don't be surprised if they're very attuned to it. They lead the way, I would go just far as to say that. However, as psychologists or counselors or psychiatrists or social workers, no. It's starting to percolate, but it is still very much in the background.
You mentioned hospice there. I did interview a guy called Dr. Christopher Kerr, who I think you talk about in your book. And he did this study into deathbed visions. And that seems like a very common form of after-death communication amongst people who are close to death.
Yes. I find it interesting because we're all talking about the same thing. It has two different names. Deathbed visions are very much after-death communication. And Dr. Kerr is, I could so relate to him because he still is very careful in how he chooses his words. He has a very reductionistic scientific background. He's a physician. And he said in one of these interviews that he started doing hospice work during the summer thinking it was temporary just till he got another job, but he loved it and stayed in it. And you're right, he got into watching these patterns and now is an advocate that speaks about it. He does not go so far as to say he speaks to mediums or he can explain what happens, but he does give it credibility and he is furthering the cause to get it out in the open and get people talking about it. And he's also doing some research on it himself. He collects videos of people.
And he's got a great book out as well. And there's other things linked to that, isn't there? Like terminal lucidity, which is quite remarkable. And it does happen. It's not like scientists, doctors could deny that.
No. And why that's so important, you know, terminal lucidity is when somebody who, as you know, who's been incapacitated to the point where they're nonverbal, suddenly can sit up in bed and talk and remember and converse as if they were perfectly fine hours before their death. What I think is important to note is that terminal lucidity, deathbed visions, and near-death experiences are all human experiences which reductionist, strict traditional medicine or science cannot explain. And which is my point, that science isn't wrong, but it's incomplete. It needs to go further, and it's starting to. But after-death communication is, as I see it, one of the next things that they're going to have to address. They can't address these things, and try as they might, they can't. I mean, on your show, you've talked about Pam Reynolds' case a couple of times at least. There's another one where they just shake their head. And in fact, when they interviewed her surgeon about her near-death experience and how did he explain it, when she was so accurate, when she was clinically dead, in describing in detail what happened during her surgery, he said, well, I've seen so many remarkable things in the operating room that I cannot begin. I would not be so smug as to dismiss it. I don't have an explanation, but I don't dismiss it. And, you know, that's meeting us halfway. And it's the truth. I mean, traditional medicine, it's wonderful and it saves lives. It has saved my life. And yet it's not complete. And I want so bad for there to be a time when we join forces and where reductionists come out and really do read the literature and look at these experiences and join forces to make sense of it. I say that somewhat reluctantly also because on the other hand, our reductionistic focus and staunch position is not that old. It's only been around a couple of hundred years. And prior to that, after-death communication and terminal lucidity and these other events were mainstream. They were accepted. Nobody said, prove it. I don't believe it. Show me the data. That wasn't part of the culture at all. It's only been recent that, and it's not even universal. There's other parts of the world, actually where I'm sitting in one, where there's no need to prove it. It's just part of life. It's like some people might say, well, love, or, you know, how can you prove love if you don't have the data, if you don't show the numbers? But most people do accept that love exists in the world and have experienced it themselves. And this is like that. And it's too bad that we're so data driven because it has its limitations. Not everything is easily quantifiable, and after-death communication being one of them. But there are research out there trying to do just that.
And does any of the research talk about how common this is? Is it that it happens a lot, but people just don't talk about it?
I think it's two things. I think it's, yes, it happens a lot and people don't talk about it. But I also think it happens and people miss it. They don't recognize it. Let me give you an example. I spoke with a woman whose husband had died from cancer. And they'd had a good long marriage. She missed him terribly. And after the funeral, she sat in his favorite chair, holding his framed portrait. And it was a stormy, rainy day in the morning. And as she sat there, a sunbeam came and touched his face. And she kind of thought, oh, that's nice. Second day, same thing. Third day, same thing. Fourth day, she sat there and nothing happened. But she never put any more emphasis on it than what a quirky kind of coincidence that is. So I think sometimes after-death communication, which can be visual, can take that form, occurs and people don't recognize it for what it is because we're not helped to. We're not shown how to do that and we miss it. So I think it is pretty common. I would not go so far as to say it's universal. But what the research shows is that, and it's not 100% agreement, but it would be somewhere in the range of 50 to 80% of the population talks about, if you inquire enough, they will talk about having had an after-death communication. And since my book has come out, I've had people write me and say, you know, I did not have the words for what you described, but I've had an ADC. I just didn't know what it was. And I've had it happen in my daily life. I had my hairstylist, I was talking about the book when I was writing it to her. I was talking about it to her, and she stopped working. And she said, you know, that fits exactly what happened to me. And I said, what happened? And she said, well, her father had died from a motorcycle accident when she was 17. When she was 18, it was the first time she went to his graveside by herself. And she had the radio on. She turned her car off, but the radio was left on. And her father's favorite song came on, which was from the band called The Eagles. And the song was Love Will Keep Us Alive. And she thought, oh, that's an interesting coincidence. His favorite song is on while I'm looking at his headstone. And right then, an eagle feather fell on the hood of her car. And she was dumbfounded. And like the others I spoke to, it never left her. It was a pivotal moment. She never felt more connected with her father since his motorcycle accident than she did at that moment. So I think those moments are there if people just have the vocabulary and awareness. And with some support, I would not be surprised if that number came out to be even higher than 50 to 80%, because people are really reluctant to talk about it.
Have you ever wondered what happens after we die? In my new book, Verified Near-Death Experiences, Proof of an Afterlife, I share 30 incredible stories of people who were clinically dead, some with no heartbeat, no brain activity, yet returned with knowledge that was later verified. These accounts challenge everything we think we know about consciousness and the afterlife. It's available now as an ebook, paperback, and audiobook on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and other good bookshops. Again, it's called Verified Near-Death Experiences, Proof of an Afterlife, and I hope you check it out. Do you find that people have these experiences and it's not like a scary thing? Because a lot of times you might think you see a ghost or, oh, that's really scary. But when these happen, it's not.
It can be. Mine was. Mine was not enjoyable. But most of the time, it's reassuring. Most of the time, it's a sense of you're still here. We're still connected. I haven't lost you. And for somebody deep in grief, there can be nothing more important than that. For some people, it's more bewildering, like they don't know what to make of it. And with some help to see it, then they're reassured by it. So there's really nothing to fear. I do get concerned that an ill-informed person might tell somebody in grief who describes something like this that, oh, that's the work of the devil, or that's an indication that you're deranged. I mean, that's the last thing a person needs when they're grieving, is to be told something like that, because you already feel apart from other people because you're deep in grief and everybody else is going on about their business. And then you have an ABC, which separates you even further from the mainstream. And then to be told something like that, it can really shut a person down. And you're not there to do harm. You're there to help. So it's very important that people who are in the role of assisting others get familiar with the literature and tools to how to bring it out and talk about it so that does not happen.
And I suppose there are people that do believe in this stuff and something happens, and so they're grieving and they're waiting for some kind of communication. It just doesn't seem to turn up.
That does happen. I think a big factor is that we have such busy lives that it's like trying to pick up a faint signal. I don't mean that exactly literally, but pick up a faint signal from a weak radio in the middle of the freeway. You're not going to do it. You need to have a quiet place. You need to maybe hold on to something personal of theirs in your hand. Talk to them. Maybe have a photograph of them. And ask questions, you know, how will I know you're communicating with me? And it could be in any form. It could be visual, auditory, olfactory, which is a sense of smell, or a combination of senses. and just be on the lookout for it. If that fails, you can also seek out a clinician who does specialize in after-death communication, which is not really what I'm focusing on, because my focus is spontaneous after-death communications. But you can have them evoked through meditation, through some people have gone to see clinicians and done certain kinds of therapy that helps bring it about. But I think it's a matter, a big factor is we just are so busy that we're not tuned in and we get sidetracked. And in fact, I think our culture does us harm by discouraging it and not giving us the tools for this. But I think it's more common than people realize. What some of the research shows is that the more open and social a person is, that kind of individual is going to be more likely to report an ADC than somebody who's very bitter and angry and reductionistic. They're not going to tune in and report it as likely.
So is there a certain frame of mind that might be helpful? I kind of imagine daydreaming is like you're almost zoning out. You could be just cleaning the dishes or doing something you do every day that you don't really need to think about. And you zone out and maybe then you're open to the frequency.
You think that's important? I think deep breathing is important, deep, slow breathing. I know for me, what helps the most is being in nature. I love being in nature. That's why I live in the woods, basically. Long walks in the woods, sleeping in a tent with no distractions, none. It's very fine-tuning. It's like you push all the other superficial stuff away, tune into what's important, and just be receptive. I think it's a mindset to some degree. And the research also shows that it's more likely to occur in the first 2 years following a death. So it behooves somebody to try to do that sooner rather than later. And being traumatized, like a homicide, makes it more likely. Any kind of event that shakes up your world is more likely to temporarily cause you to be more open, because you've lost your footing. The world has shifted and you're grasping at straws. And so I think you're less defensive, less grounded, and allowing that information in. And I think that's what happened with me. Also, reading books on it can be helpful. Listening to shows like yours can be helpful. Also, there are good videos out on it. There's some, like a book I would recommend is to read Bill and Judy Guggenheim's book, Hello from Heaven, is one source. It's just a series of little vignettes that he describes. And what I think is interesting and not surprising, really, is that he also had an ADC experience that got him involved in writing his book and collecting these case studies over the years, as is so often the case. Talk to people who've had an ADC. And I think it just helps you exhale and be receptive. It's like you have to wind back from the culture's mandates and tune in. And it's easier to do if you're among people who think as you do.
Do other people get what you kind of got, which was when they get an after-death communication before they know that person has died?
Yes, that can happen. All the people on my show already knew, my podcast already knew the person had died. But yes, you can have that happen. And sometimes it's even through a third party. I've read cases, this was not a personal experience of somebody telling me this, but I have read cases where an individual was rather shut down, not open to receiving this information, and a third party was involved. So they would come to the person and say, you need to go and contact your aunt because I got a message. I don't know how to describe it, but I got a message saying that your niece has perished and you need to talk with your aunt about that. And they would go and talk to their aunt about it and find out, yeah, their niece had perished. So it can happen in different ways. And also, there are premonitions that something as bad is about to happen and can even be averted. I had another guest on the show whose father was murdered in the line of duty. He was a police officer in North Hollywood, California. And because he testified in open court, it was payback for doing so. And they timed his murder to deliberately to coincide with him receiving his son coming out of that daycare. They wanted to traumatize his little boy in the process. And it was a brutal murder in front of his little boy. And his daughter, who was older than her brother, said that about two or three times she would be on the freeway and she would hear her father say to her, "Go in the right lane, go in the right lane." And she would, because she'd had ADCs prior and she trusted it, and she averted an accident. So she averted her own death as a result of responding to and paying attention to what her father was telling her. So it can serve practical purposes besides just bringing about a sense of connection.
And there's a thing called a crisis apparition. Is that different to the kind of ADC you've been talking about?
I would say a crisis apparition is more like what I had, where a tragedy has occurred. Billie Holiday, as a famous singer in the States, also had a crisis apparition. She was in a hotel room and she was very close. Well, she had a up and down relationship with her mother. They was close, but then they'd have their spiffs too. And she was in her hotel room. Her mother was not ill. And she felt her mother's hands gently come on her shoulders. And she instantly knew her mother had died. She rather was panicked about it. She went out to talk to her manager, who was out in the lobby, and he said, "Who told you that?" I told everybody not to tell you, because she was due to go on the stage in a little bit and perform, and he didn't want her upset right before her performance. And she said, "My mother told me. I heard it. I felt it directly." And he was, of course, dumbfounded. So that's another example of a crisis apparition, where you feel, where you sense or you get a communication about of an immediate death at the time. In my case, he had been dead about 4 hours when I had that experience looking in the mirror. So it was not immediate. And the thing that strikes me as interesting about that is the wording, because when I got that message, it said, "He's dead. He's not coming home." The message was not, "I'm dead. I'm not coming home." I've never quite known what to make of that. It's just an unanswered question. I don't know why it was worded that way. Maybe it was to give me more distance from it. I don't know. I have no idea. But yeah, crisis apparitions are those which are meant to inform of an immediate tragedy.
And have you had other after-death communications since then over the decades?
No, I have not. I have only had the one. I've had other, what's the word for it? Cognitive. I kept a journal and I wanted to test myself. I kept a journal of things that, like, I was expecting something to happen and I would write down the details and see if it happened. And it didn't always pan out, but I had one the other day. I wrote down, "Tomorrow I'm going to go," I do photography on the side. And I said in my journal, "Tomorrow I'm going to go to Port Townsend," and went to do photography. And in being there, I'm going to run into an elderly man with white hair who knows something about photography. Okay, so I'm out going about my business and I like to photograph old buildings and the waterfronts, things of that nature. And so I found myself down on the waterfront, and there's an area where it's old buildings that are abandoned, and they're very photogenic in my mind. So I rounded a corner. It was like a dock, and I rounded a corner quickly because it was getting darker out. I wanted to get this image before it got too dark. And I almost stepped on somebody. And I said, oh, I'm so sorry. I didn't know you were, he was sitting on the boardwalk right around the corner. And he looked up at me and he had white hair and a beard. And he said, oh, that's all right. That's all right. He says, what are you doing? And I said, I'm taking photographs. It's such a beautiful area. And he goes, oh, I know it is. He said, I used to do TV productions years ago and I don't do much photography anymore. And I'm like, oh, that's interesting. And I completely forgot why I was there. But, you know, I wouldn't say I have had an ADC, but I've had things like that happen more than once. Another one was involved a school bus being in an accident. And I said, I am positive someplace. And I described the street. I wrote it down. The trees are going to be gold in the background, gold and red from fall. There's not going to be any serious injuries, but some of the children are going to be taken to the hospital. There's going to be an arrest. And it's going to be raining out, and it's going to be not a residential street, but not an expressway, kind of like a small road. And I set it aside. And 2 days later in the news in the Midwest, there was exactly that. And I looked at the picture that they posted on the news, and there it was. It was exactly how I had pictured it in my mind. I cannot say if this is new. I mean, I don't know if this is something I used to do 20, 30, 40 years ago. I don't know. But since I've kept track of them, I feel more confident about them because I'm writing down the dates and the details and I'm not forcing it. I'm just like, okay, let's see what happens. And it doesn't always pan out, but most of the time it does, which I find interesting.
I was interested to read in your book the story about Winston Churchill at the White House.
Yes, Winston Churchill. He was in the White House as a guest, taking a bath, smoking a cigar in the bathtub, I might add. And when he got out, he was dripping wet, drying himself off. And he looked out the bathroom door towards the window, and he saw an image of Abraham Lincoln. It was so vivid, he dropped his towel, and he said something like, I don't know the exact words, but something like, you have me in a compromised state. He was so undone by this experience that he went back and told, I think it was King George, but went back and told the king about his experience. He said, I'm probably the only head of state who's ever received an American president in the news.
But was there other reports people in the White House saw Abraham Lincoln?
Yes. And with Abraham Lincoln and in the Lincoln bedroom. President's daughters have seen him and other guests visiting from other countries have seen him. And he's usually pensive and he's kind of invisible from the knees down. It's mostly from the knees up that you can see him. He's a rather opaque and he doesn't say any words, but he's there looking rather pensive. And so it's been, I don't know, 3-4 people besides Churchill have seen him, to the point where some guests of the White House don't want to sleep in the Lincoln bedroom for fear that might happen to them, which is kind of silly because nothing bad is going to come of it. But I thought that'd be interesting.
Yeah, yeah. So an interesting thing about the after-death communication is that the people that are passed on that are communicating, they can find you. It's not like they go to your house to give you this communication. You're not there and think, oh, all right, I'm gonna have to wait till they come home. They can get straight to you. They know where you are.
Yeah, it's like the way it's experienced is the setting is less important than the mindset. And you could be driving, you could be at home, you could be walking someplace, and you experience it. It doesn't always have the same form. It can be, as I said, something visual, something olfactory. And it's like, and almost the sense I get is an omnipresence. Like they're not bound by matter like we are in this world. And they seek your energy and you align with them. And so finding you isn't the hurdle. The hurdle is, will you be receptive to them when they find you?
Do you have any stories where there are multiple witnesses to, like, an apparition or something?
Yes, one that comes to mind. This was probably the one that had the biggest impact on me. It was a podcast interview I did, and it was a counselor helping a young man come to grips with a brutal murder of his parents by his younger brother. After the funeral, and this younger man, the one he was helping out, had been away to college. He wasn't home at the time of the murder. And in fact, he hadn't been back to that house in about a year. But after the funeral, it had been boarded up, and he had inherited it because of the way the laws are. And so he said to the counselor, I think I want to go back and see the house. And that's where the murders took place. And the counselor said, are you sure? And he goes, yeah, I want to go back. And he goes, okay. So they went back to the house. And the guy, the young man, was explaining things like, oh, this is where our Christmas tree used to be. And this was my parents' room. And this was where my mom's garden was, you know, just typical stuff like that. But when they got to the kitchen, which is where one of his parents was murdered, the counselor said he experienced that the room temperature dropped. He felt wind. He felt a negative presence, like a grumbling sound. Not something you could make sense of, but a grumbling, windy sound. And he was very careful not to look at the young man for fear of scaring him. So he looked the other way to keep it private. And when he did look back at the young man standing next to him, he was white as a sheet. And he said to the counselor, did you hear that? And he goes, what did you hear? And he said, I heard people talking. It was very scary. And I feel the temperature dropping in the room. And he was a very distraught individual. I mean, his parents had just been terribly killed. And he said, am I next? Am I going to die? And he goes, no. And he said, what should we do? And the counselor said, let's pray. And they did. And it stopped immediately. And that's in their book called A Thousand Fireflies. It was it's a very well written book, by the way. And so that was an experience of two people sharing the same negative after death communication.
And there's religion there. Do you find that people have after death communication regardless of their religion or their culture?
Absolutely. The studies that have been done, there's been some international studies on this. One was by Evelyn Elassier from Switzerland. And she, in fact, it's ongoing. Anybody that wants to chime in, it's an ongoing study. She's already published one book, but she's going to keep going. It's in four or five languages now. And she describes ADC experiences from the perspective of people who have witnessed it in a variety of contexts. And that was one of the variables that she looked at. And she found that not only was there no correlation between having a religious preference prior to an ADC and afterwards, but there was not a significant change. There was some, but not a significant change after the fact. So, in other words, people that were very involved in their religion were no more likely to have an ADC than an atheist. But the one thing she did find was that once people have had an ADC, they are more likely to become more spiritual, not necessarily religious, but more spiritual. But it didn't have any bearing on it, no.
Well, it's been great talking to you. The book's called Rekindled, Healing Grief Through the Science and Experience of After-Death Communication. People can get that on Amazon, can't they?
They can. And I want to thank you for having me as a guest and also for doing your work, because it impacted me. I must say it furthered my journey on this path, and It's a very valuable outlet. So thank you for what you do.
Thank you. Can people hear your podcast? Where would they find it?
It's anywhere that they usually listen to podcasts. It's called Domino Effect of Murder. Not the, just Domino Effect of Murder. And it's mostly homicide survivors, but I do have people related in the field, like detectives, blood specialists, attorneys. I have interviewed two murderers on the show. That was, I hadn't expected that, but they came and asked to be on the show. And I had an individual that was wrongly accused and convicted of a murder he did not do, which was another domino effect of murder. And he was on the show, and he eventually got me involved in the Innocence Project. But the show is on any conventional platform.
Fantastic. It's been really great talking to you. Thanks a lot for coming on.
Thank you for having me, Simon. Good luck to you.
This week, I was talking to Jan Canty about her book, Rekindled, Healing Grief Through the Science and Experience of After-Death Communication. If you want to hear the rest of this amazing interview, you can sign up to Patreon. When you sign up for $6 a month, you get an extended episode every week. For $3 a month, you get an extended episode every month. The Patreon episodes are ad-free and are released 2 days before the free versions. You can become a patron by going to patreon.com/ourparanormalafterlife or click on the patron button on my homepage at pastliveshypnosis.co.uk. The links are in the show notes. And my book titled Verified Near-Death Experiences is on Amazon. You can get it on paperback, audiobook or Kindle. And if you enjoy the podcast, please leave a review and be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify or via your favourite podcast app to make sure that you don't miss out on any episodes. And thanks for listening.